Hello, my name is Rob Bennett. I'm the author of a book entitled Passion Saving, The Path to Plentiful Free Time and Soul-Satisfying Work. I'm also the publisher of the PassionSaving.com website, and I'm working on a second book entitled Investing for Humans, How to Get What Works on Paper to Work in Real Life. This is podcast number 117. I'm recording it on Monday, March 30th, 2009. The PE10 level today is 14. That's fair value. Stocks purchased at today's prices offer a strong long-term value proposition. The music for the podcast is by Kevin McLeod at the Incompetech.com website. The title of this particular selection is Malt Shop Bop. The title of the podcast is a provocative one. Stocks are less risky than bonds. That is a provocative title. This is an exciting podcast because in this podcast, we are taking the lessons we have learned in the first 7 years of discussions in the Great Safe Withdrawal Rate debate to a new level, I believe. Exploring some... The way it worked is that I put up the post at Motley Fool on May 13th, 2002, pointing out the analytical errors in the old school safe withdrawal rate studies, the studies that we all use to plan our retirements, that financial planners use to advise us when we have enough money to retire. And those discussions have led us in lots of interesting directions. And one of the things that came up a lot in the early days, it was clear that there were a number of big shots, people who had put out calculators that got the numbers wrong, or studies that got the numbers wrong, or books that got the numbers wrong. And they were going to cause a lot of trouble in the retire early and indexing discussion board communities if we didn't drop this thing about calculating the safe withdrawal rate accurately. And people would say, well, Rob, you know, is it really that important? Why don't you just drop it? You know, we don't need to know accurate numbers. Now, I don't agree with that. I think we do need accurate numbers to plan our retirements. I think the idea is preposterous. But the thing I would always argue is it's not just a question of getting the safe withdrawal rate right. It goes deeper than that. What I would often point out is learning in any field, and this is true in investing as well as in any other field, learning is a building block process. That means the way we learn. Think about computers. It's incredible when you think, you know, what you can do with a computer today. You push a button and you've got a video playing, you know, Lord of the Rings, and it's playing there on your computer screen. I had a guy, I was watching, I don't have my computer set up for this, but I was watching one of my boys' Little League games last summer, and the guy next to me, he was on his computer, and he's you know, he's doing work, and he's, you know, playing videos, and you know, listening to podcasts, whatever. And he's doing it because he's got it hooked up to his cell phone. So, the computer's going up to the satellite. It's connecting with a phone system, and he's on the internet, and he's sitting there at a Little League game. It's amazing. And you've got, you know, videos and all these things. And all it is ones and zeros, right? Isn't that what they tell us computers are? It's all code, which essentially reduces to ones and zeros. But look what we did with those ones and zeros. I remember when my older brother got my father the first video game. I think it was that Pong game. And the ball would just sort of bounce, and it would go from one end of the screen to the other. You would hook it up to your television screen. And, you know, of course, it's pathetic today, but it was exciting at the time. You were like, holy moly, how does it do that? You know, how does it get that ball to bounce? That was the graphics. You know, it was a little ping pong ball bouncing from one side of the screen to the other. And people were amazed. But the point is, you have to start somewhere. You don't start by putting out, you know, you couldn't, there was no way any human being could have started with a machine that you would open up and you would play Lord of the Rings on it. And, you know, you could also hooked up to an internet that had 7 kajillion websites on it, and you could open it up at your boy's Little League game and do the work there and play video games and all this sort of thing. Nobody could have imagined any of that. They had to start somewhere. They started, you know, the reason they're called computers is they used to compute things. That was the original purpose. You know, they were like calculators, really. That's what they were. Just, you put a little code in so you could calculate big numbers that you couldn't calculate in your head. And now they've turned into these, you know, we live, you know, some of us live our lives on the internet. But it started with something small, and then we build on that. Well, it's the same way. That's how we learn in any field. The first airplane, you know, it was a very simple airplane, and, you know, it took years for it to turn into a jumbo jet, you know, whatever. Well, that's the way we have to learn about investing. We had to start somewhere getting the numbers right. You never can get to advanced, sophisticated knowledge unless you get the basics right. And the problem with the old school safe withdrawal rate studies is they get all the numbers wrong, because they are rooted in the passive investing model of understanding how stock investing works. That was the point of the last podcast, podcast number 116. What if everything you know about investing is wrong? If you believe in the efficient market theory, which is the intellectual framework for the passive investing model, everything you think you know about investing is wrong, because the first thing you know about investing is wrong. It's not true that the market is efficient. It's just not true. So we've been branching, we've been exploring this knowledge. We first built the base. We had to learn, if the efficient market theory isn't true, well, what is true? We had to figure out how stocks work. Well, we've got that down, I hope. If anyone finds any flaws in any of the work we've done, I hope you'll bring it to my attention so we can fix it. But presuming that no one finds flaws and no one has found any serious flaws in the first 7 years, we've now got a foundation. We've got a working foundation. Well, now that we have a working foundation, we don't know just how to calculate safe withdrawal rates. That's not the extent of our knowledge. That's the beginning. That's the first thing. Now we just keep building and building and building, and we never stop. What essentially we had to do on May 13th, or, you know, soon thereafter, when we had proved beyond any reasonable doubt that the old school studies were wrong, is we had to wash clean everything we thought we knew about stock investing, because we had determined that we had the basics wrong, and then we had to start rebuilding. And of course, it's slow in the early going. Those early years, you're trying to figure out, well, the efficient market isn't where it's at. You know, what is right? But over time, we filled in those pieces. Thanks to hundreds of community members who helped out, but thanks in particular to John Walter Russell, who did the research. Which, you know, I don't think without that research, we ever could have gotten over that hump. I just don't think it would have been possible. And he's gone beyond the bounds of what any human being could have been expected to have done to help his community. John Seitz, if you're one of the unfortunate souls who hasn't discovered it yet, is early-retirement-planning-insights.com. So now look at the question. Look at the sorts of questions we're looking at today. Stocks are less risky than bonds. I certainly never thought on May 13th, 2002, that there'd be a day 7 years in the future when I would be telling people that stocks are less risky than bonds. That that conventional wisdom that that stocks are more risky than bonds. First of all, I don't know that there's ever been a time when that hasn't been the conventional wisdom. As far back in my lifetime as I knew anything about stocks, that's what I had always heard. And I don't know that there's anyone else who says this, what I'm saying in this podcast. Given how many people post on the internet, my guess is there must be someone else out there saying that stocks are less risky than bonds. But if you know of such a person, I'd be grateful if you would drop me an email. Go to the website, passionsaving.com, and look for the Contact Rob button at the left side of every page and drop me an email and let me know. I don't know of anyone else saying this. And I'm going to make the case. And I think it's right. Now, before I get into the argument, I do want to say, I think it's a good thing if people talking about investing would make it a practice to say how confident they are of things they're saying. There was a great blog entry today at the Four Pillars blog about how people in the money field make a mistake of stating things they believe too strongly. And boy, do I ever agree with that. We all need to be more humble. We all need to note that we don't know everything. We all need to be open to new ideas. But something that would help is to say, you know, sometimes you're really sure. You know, if you ask me, Rob, do you think the old school safe withdrawal rate studies are analytically invalid? I'm not going to be too, soft on that one. Because I've studied it in such depth, I'm highly confident. Nothing can ever be 100%, but I would put that one at 99.999. I'd say the odds that I'm right about that one are greater than the odds that the moon is not made of green cheese. But on this one, I don't feel that way. On this one, I need a lot more feedback from a lot of people before I would feel confident. But I believe that what I'm saying here is true. I believe that stocks are less risky than bonds. I would put my confidence level in this one at something between 60 and 70%. So greater than 50%, but not anything close to certainty at this point. So I want you to know that before we start. But I'll make the case. And I think it stands up to scrutiny. I think the idea holds up. I've been thinking about this one for a few months. And I've held back doing a podcast with the thought that I should write this up in an article. And there are a number of cases where I've recorded podcasts that were previously in written form. And of course, I don't read the article. I take a different route with it, but the same general concept as was followed in an article I follow in a podcast. In this one, I'm doing the podcast first. I decided I'm just going to go ahead and do the podcast because I'm in a podcasty kind of mood lately, and there will come a day then when I'll be back writing articles and I'll write an article on it. So in this one, the podcast comes first. The article will come later. Also, final prefatory note, I wanted to let you know about podcast number 79, which explores a similar theme. If you're interested in the theme of this podcast, you may want to check out podcast number 79, What Should You Be Invested In When You're Not Invested in Stocks? And that was a podcast I recorded in response to an email from a community member, Colleen, I believe her name was. And she asked about, and that one talked quite a bit about bonds and tips and I-bonds, things of that nature. So it's a related theme to this one. Now, as I say, it's long been conventional wisdom that stocks are more risky than bonds. And if you believe in the efficient market theory / passive investing, the two things are pretty much the same thing. They're not exactly the same thing, but it's the efficient market theory is the intellectual framework for the passive investing model. And all the investing advice, or 90% of the investing advice you've heard over the past 30 years, is rooted in the passive investing model, which comes from the efficient market theory. And if you believe in the efficient market theory, you cannot believe the title of this podcast. It's impossible, if the efficient market theory is true, that stocks would be less risky than bonds. So let me start by explaining why most investing experts of today will tell you that the title of this podcast not only is false, but must be false. Not only is false in reality, but is impossible. It's theoretically impossible. The efficient market theory, all the conventional advice comes from this. It's the reason we've had this stock crash. It's the reason we're suffering this economic crisis. It's the reason you've fallen so far behind in your retirement plan. It's the efficient market theory. So I talk about it in almost every podcast. The efficient market theory says that stock investing is a rational endeavor. That's clean up all the hoo-ha that surrounds it. That's the core idea. Now, part of that, you take that idea, and it's an idea that produced some good fruit in earlier years. The efficient market theory is, I often say, it's a crazy idea or, you know, a bad idea, whatever. It's bad today because it's done so much harm. But that doesn't mean it was always bad. It was actually a very strong idea. It was actually a very good idea once upon a time. It led to a lot of powerful insights. But the unfortunate thing is, as the evidence accumulated over the past 28 years, that the efficient market theory does not explain how stock investing works, that the theory is flawed, that the theory is wrong, the people who had promoted the theory were reluctant, highly reluctant, to acknowledge either that they had made a mistake or that they were not sure. And so this theory, they continued to promote it years after they should have backed down, at least, if not reversed themselves. And that's why we ended up in the terrible straits we're in today. But the idea is not a crazy idea. The idea, although it's wrong, it is wrong. And once you see why it's wrong, it does seem sort of crazy. But when you first hear it, it doesn't sound crazy. The idea is that investors are trying to maximize their return. Makes sense, doesn't it? Well, if investors are trying to maximize their return, if investors are rational, stocks would have to be more risky than bonds, because stocks provide a higher long-term return than bonds. People who theorize about investing, they try to explain things like that. They say, well, why? Why do stocks provide a higher return? And the idea, the conventional idea is stocks provide a higher return because stocks are more risky. You see, if two entities were to offer you investment vehicles, places to put your money, and one provided a higher return than the other, and they had equal risk, everyone who was rational would go for the higher return asset. So the only way to explain a lower return is to say, well, this asset has less risk. In other words, the asset isn't appealing to those who want a high return. It's appealing to those who want less risk. So, for example, if you compare stocks and money market accounts obviously are less risky than stocks. But stocks obviously provide a much higher return. So the theory is you get one or the other. You can get high returns if you want high returns. You can get high safety if you want high safety, but if you want returns, you're going to have to take on risk. That's the price of a high return. If that's true, and that is the conventional wisdom, that's the passive investing model, if that's true, stocks should be more risky than bonds. And certainly, there are ways of looking at it where you could say they are more risky. This stock crash we've just lived through sure makes stocks look more risky, doesn't it? We've lost, if you go back to January of 2000, the loss in the stock market is now around 65%. Big loss, and that's in real terms, inflation-adjusted terms. 65%. That's risky. Bonds, you know in advance what your return's going to be. Buy a bond, you might get a 6% return, so you know what you're going to get. So it sure looks like stocks are more risky. Rob, you've painted yourself into a corner, my friend. How are you going to get out of this one? You're like Batman. You one of those evil arch villains. They've got you tied up, and there's a drill aimed at your stomach, and they're turning on the juice. Fortunately, in Batman, the bad guy always leaves the room. After he puts Batman in a precarious position, he leaves the room, and Batman gets to figure out how to get out of it without his archenemy there to stop him. So see if I can get out of this one. I say stocks are less risky, and yet we've just lived through a stock crash in which people invested in stocks lost, 50% just in the last 18 months or so. And yet bonds, you know in advance what your return is going to be. Doesn't sound very risky. Well, the truth is, bonds are a whole lot more risky than they look. And I think a whole lot more risky than most people realize. Because bonds, yes, you know the return. And I'm not talking about Treasury inflation protected securities here. They are a type of bond, but they're a new type. I'm really talking about the traditional bond that is not inflation adjusted. So, yes, you might know in advance I'm going to get a 6% return, but you don't know what inflation's going to be. And the nominal return really is meaningless. You need to know your inflation-adjusted return. That's what counts. So a 6% return in a 0% inflation environment is fantastic. But a 6% return in an environment where inflation is 15% is awful. And we don't know which one's going to prevail going forward. And, there are a lot of people right now worried because we're taking on these trillion-dollar debts with all these, bailouts going through Congress, that a lot of people are now thinking that inflation at some point is going to skyrocket. And if inflation skyrockets, where does that leave bondholders? Leaves them up the river. So bonds are probably, I don't study bonds. This is any comments I make about bonds are sort of off the cuff. But bonds clearly carry some risk today. But I think they've carried some risk for a number of decades now, ever since inflation got a little out of control. For many years, bonds really were very safe because for many years in the United States, inflation was under 2% for a long time. And in the 1970s, inflation just went crazy. And we sort of reined it in there for a while, but it's unclear whether that's going to last. And so we're sort of in a new era where inflation is a big enemy of the investor. You can't count on it staying under control. It might, but you can't count on it. And if you can't count on it, there's risk. So even the chance that inflation could get out of control puts the bond owner at risk. So bonds are clearly a risky asset. But are they more risky than stocks? That's what you're saying. When you say stocks are less risky than bonds, you're saying bonds are more risky. Saying that just because of inflation? No. No, the focus here is the stock part. I'm saying stocks are less risky than we thought they were. And the reason that we think of stocks as being risky is because of this theory, this efficient market theory, this passive investing model for understanding how stock investing works. Under that model, stocks have to be the riskiest asset class because they're the highest return asset class. And the assumption of that model is rationality. It's the root assumption, the very first thing, the premise. If that premise is not true, all of the implications of the model do not apply. And I say it's not true. Investing is not a 100% rational endeavor, not even close. I say it's roughly a 70% emotional endeavor. And the rational part is about 30% of what's going on. So the passive investing model gets 30% right and 70% wrong. And as a result, all of its conclusions are more wrong than right. And so it is with this conclusion that stocks are more risky than bonds. What the efficient market theory tells us is that stocks should be more risky than bonds. They should be. But does that mean they are? Well, according to the efficient market theory, stocks should always offer a higher return than money market accounts. Stocks are a high-risk asset class. Money markets are as safe as you can get. So stocks should always offer a higher return than money markets, but do they? Look at the stock return predictor. January 2000, the PE 10 level was 44. Plug 44 into that calculator and see what you get as the long-term return for stocks, the 10-year return. It's a negative number. Stocks were priced at the top of the bubble to provide a long-term negative return. That's not better than money markets. Money markets provide a low return, but it's a positive number. That's not rational. What's going on? What's going on is that investing is not a rational endeavor. Investing is a highly emotional endeavor. In a rational world, what would happen is if you offered an asset class that was high risk and that provided a negative return, nobody would buy it. So according to the efficient market theory, the PE 10 level that applied in January of 2000 is a logical impossibility. But it happened. The fact that it happened shows that the theory is wrong. The fact that the theory is wrong means we need to question all sorts of things we've learned under this theory. And one of the things I think we need to question is the idea that stocks are always more risky than bonds. There are clearly times when stocks offer worse returns than money markets. How do we know that there aren't times when stocks might be less risky than bonds? The answer is there are. What's really going on when people tell you that stocks are more risky than bonds, they're committing the same error that the authors of the old school safe withdrawal rates studies committed. What those studies do is, if you use an analytically valid methodology to determine the safe withdrawal rate, what you get is, at times of low valuations, when the PE 10 level is around 8, the safe withdrawal rate can go as high as 9%. And at times when the PE 10 level is insanely high, like it was at the top of the bubble, the safe withdrawal rate can go down to 2%. So the studies say it's always 4. How do they get 4? Well, 4 is the number that pops out of that methodology they use, the analytically invalid methodology. What the methodology is really doing is taking all of the time periods and throwing them all together into one big bowl of data soup. And the number that pops out is more or less an average number. You're not getting the safe withdrawal rate that applies at a time of high valuations. You're not getting the safe withdrawal rate that applies at times of low valuations. You're getting roughly the safe withdrawal rate that applies on average. But we don't invest on average. We always invest at a particular time and in particular circumstances. So knowing the safe withdrawal rate that applies on average doesn't tell you how much you need to retire. It tells you how much you need to retire if you could go back in a time machine to a time when valuations were average. But you can't. What people need is to know what the safe withdrawal rate is on the day they retire. And that's a number that always changes depending on valuations, depending on the valuation level that applies. Well, the same thing is true when you're trying to determine how risky stocks are. Stocks are not, or it's wrong to think of stocks as a single asset class. Stocks, if you look at the historical data, what you see is when stocks are priced low or moderate, when there are low or moderate prices, stocks are a moderately risky asset class. There is some risk. Stocks do, there is some risk in stocks. They're not risk-free, certainly. But the risk is not nearly as great as most people think it is. There's never been a bone-crushing price drop from a time of low or moderate prices, one that stayed in effect for a significant length of time. If you look at stocks at times of insanely high prices, like the prices that applied from 1995 through the first part of 2008, stocks are the worst asset class on the face of planet Earth. Every time stocks have reached those price levels, all investors invested heavily in stocks have suffered bone-crushing losses. So stocks are two investment classes mixed into one. They're an extreme, insanely risky asset class, and then a moderate risky asset class. And when you mix the two together, you get a high-risk asset class. And that's what people are looking at when they say stocks are riskier than bonds. They're looking at the mix, and the mix is a high-risk asset class, an asset class riskier than bonds. But there's no law that says you have to invest in stocks when they're insanely risky. There's no law. And if you elect out of the insanely high-risk asset class, and for you, stocks means investing in a moderately risky asset class, the asset class that applies at times of moderate and low valuations, you have just, with a wave of your hand, done away with 70 to 80% of the risk of stock investing. Almost all of the, not all, but almost all of the risk of stock investing is the chance that you will someday fall for the idea that timing doesn't work and that you need to put a high amount of your retirement money in stocks at times of insanely dangerous prices. If you learn that one lesson from this stock crash and you never again do that, you'll be able to retire years earlier than you can retire not knowing that. It's the most important lesson of stock investing. The one that the passive investing marketing slogans have been trying to drive out of your head for 30 years now. That's common sense. Common sense tells you there's a price at which stocks are not a good buy. But the marketing slogans drive that idea out of your head and cause you to lose 5 or 10 years on how long it would take to finance your retirement. So when I say stocks are less risky than bonds, what I mean is if you invest in stocks in a valuation-informed way, stocks are less risky than bonds. There is no law that you ignore valuations. And if you're simply willing to take valuations into account, most of the risk of stock investing disappears. And you now have an asset class that provides a return far better than bonds, but at less risk than bonds. The best of both worlds. Passive investors will tell you that's impossible. That's because passive investors assume rationality. So they're living in an imaginary world where all investing is 100% rational. In the real world, investing is highly emotional, and if you're willing to look at valuations, you know when stocks are dangerous, and you can lower your stock allocations at those times, and thereby avoid most of the risk. Now, the discovery that got me hot on this question was something that John Russell and I were discussing some months back. And it was part of the, I think it was part of our efforts to develop the calculator, the investment strategy tester, I think. That's where it came up. But one of the things we were looking at is the stock return predictor calculator at the website tells you the odds of various long-term returns. So you know the probabilities of your stock investment, what's likely to happen with your money. We can't, what people would love is if we could tell you what's going to happen to your money in a year or 2 years. That would be a hot one. But we can't do that. The data doesn't permit it. Short-term predictions don't work. At 5 years, you can make a prediction. And it would be, you know, you might be able to have, you know, a little bit of validity to it. But the problem is at 5 years, you can't be precise enough and have a statistically valid prediction. To have a statistically valid prediction, you have to go out 10 years. So that's what we do with the return predictor. We start at 10 years. And then we give numbers for 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, 60 years. But we don't give anything less than 10 because those numbers are 1 year and 2 year would have no validity at all. And 5 years, it's dubious. 10 years, pretty good. But a pretty big range of possibilities. Not precise numbers, but statistically valid numbers. I'm always interested in knowing, you know, in finding ways to make the pitch, finding ways to explain to people what we've done. Not just John and I, but the whole community, the Retire Early Indexing community. And one of the things I wanted to do was to do some little graphics that would say how predictable stock returns are. And there are statistical tools you can use to do this. You can say something is, you know, how predictable is it? At 10 years, the predictability is pretty good. At 15 years, it's amazing. 20 years is the highest level of predictability. And the percentage predictability at 20 years is 78%. That means you can run a statistical test, and what it will tell you is, if you know the PE10 level at any given day in the historical record, you could predict 78% of what the return is going to be in 20 years. 22% is random. You can't get that part. So stock returns are never 100% predictable. But they're 78% predictable when you go out 20 years. I find that just stunning and amazing. And that's what put the idea into my head when I saw that there's 78%, you know, this is compares to passive investing that tells you there's 0% predictable. You have no idea. Look at the advance from 0 to 78%. As far as I'm concerned, risk, I think the best definition of risk is unpredictability. If you know what's going to happen, there's not a risk. It's a choice. You may choose to do it or not to do it, but there's no risk. You know the realities. Risk is not knowing. And looking at valuations, your ability to predict stock returns goes from 0% to 78%. That's how big a difference it makes to acknowledge that valuations affect long-term returns. Well, when I learned that the number is 78% at 20 years, the thought hit me, wait a minute. How about this conventional wisdom that stocks are more risky than bonds? Is that even true? I doubt that bonds are 78% predictable at 20 years. Now, bonds are totally predictable in terms of the return you're going to get. You know, it's written on the piece of paper. But what's not predictable is the inflation rate, so you don't know your real return. And I'm almost sure that the real return on bonds is less. When I say stock returns are 78% predictable, I'm talking real return. So I'm almost sure that the real, you know, I don't know the number for bonds, how predictable they are. And of course, it, you know, as I say, it would depend on inflation, and it's a little hard to predict that because inflation wasn't a factor, much of a factor through most of the historical record. It's become a big factor, but only in recent years, and we don't have much data to work from. So even if someone tried to work up the numbers on that, I doubt they could do a very good job of it. But intuitively, knowing how big a risk inflation has become, it seems to me the risk on bonds is much greater than 22% unpredictability. It's much higher risk. So that tells me from a common sense standpoint, bonds are riskier than stocks. For the valuation-informed indexer, not for the guy who goes in and says, I'm passive, I refuse to look at valuations. No, for that guy, stocks truly are, you know, frighteningly risky. My view is, if you're going to invest passively, if you're not going to look at valuations, I don't think you should be invested in stocks at all. That's my opinion. I just don't think it makes sense. It's like buying a car without looking at the price. Just makes no sense. But if you're willing to look at price, if you're willing to consider valuations, bonds are less risky. Now, that's the common sense argument. But our tradition at PassionSaving.com is to start with common sense. That's what we did with the safe withdrawal rates. I knew nothing about what the data said on safe withdrawal rates when I first started posting in May of 2002. On the problems with the old school studies. I knew from a common sense standpoint that those studies couldn't be right. And then John, Walter Russell, got involved and he did the research, and lots of other people helped. Lots of other people did research too. And as we did more research, we found lots of things, lots of experts who agreed, you know, all sorts of things on the internet, all sorts of evidence. But John's research is the most important evidence. And what that research does is it's not what told me that the old school studies are wrong, but it sure added a lot of confirmation. It sure made me feel a lot more comfortable with what my common sense told me. Because the problem most investors are having, my experience is that most middle class investors have common sense and understand that the price at which they buy stocks must affect the long-term return. But these marketing slogans have had their influence. They've heard them so many times that they just can't believe that it's all wrong. It is all wrong, but they it's hard to accept. And for me, what helped me not listen to the marketing slogans was knowing what the historical data said. Because the marketing slogans are persuasive through repetition, because they're repeated 1,000 times, there's something in the human mind that says it must be true if you've heard it 1,000 times. That's what television commercials are all about. But the historical data, you can look at as many times as you want. And, you know, you can look at it every day. That's what the calculators are there for. If you hear on a television program or a radio program or a discussion board or the newspaper that timing doesn't work, stay stocks for the long run, stay the course, buy and hold. If you hear those marketing slogans every day, guess what? You can go and check the historical data every day. Give common sense a fighting chance. Fight back. Every time you hear a marketing slogan, a passive investing marketing slogan, go to the website. Look at what the historical data says. That will make the side of your brain wants to have confidence in common sense that much stronger. And I'm not being facetious, really. I'm being a little bit comical in the way I say it, but I do that. When I start to get shaky, I go back to the historical data, whether it means going to the calculators or going to Robert Shiller's site or whatever. You have to, this is all a battle of toughening up your common sense. That's the only way you're going to become an effective long-term investor. The experts are not going to help you for the most part. You're going to have to do some of this on your own. The experts are a big help once you have the BS filter in place. Once you're able to filter out the marketing slogans, then the experts are gold. But you've got to have that BS filter. And that comes from studying the historical data and from not studying it once by making regular reference to it. So let's look at the historical data. On the question of whether stocks are less risky than bonds. I put together a I did a calculation of the new calculator, the investment strategy tester. I'll tell you what to enter to make this, you know, so you can create this graphic for yourself. The investment strategy tester does not study bonds, so I couldn't compare bonds with stocks in a direct way. But what I did was I created a made-up asset class that never has an annual result of less than a gain of 2.5% real. The calculator will look at Treasury inflation-protected securities, which, you know, you can specify the annual gain, whether it's 1% or 2% or 3%. So what I wanted to do was to create an asset class that was very low risk. And I felt that an asset class that provides a guaranteed return every single year, I'm defining risk as loss. So by risky, a risky asset class is one where you can suffer a big loss. And the asset class I created to compare to stocks is one where you're guaranteed a gain every year of 2.5% real, 2.5% plus inflation. Now, since this is a made-up asset class, when I tell you how to create this on the calculator, you can't compare the upside of this asset class with the upside for stocks. The upside for stocks will be much higher. And the upside for stocks is indeed much higher than the upside for bonds. That's I think, virtually universal opinion in the long term. But this calculator will not give you the upside properly because I didn't really create bonds. What I did was create a mythical asset class that can never go down, that always goes up at least 2.5% real per year. So the upside is artificial. The upside is the upside you would have with tips, but tips that pay 2.5% real. But that's not bonds. So you can't say that the upside on this graphic is the upside for bonds. But what I'm looking at is the downside, the risk. And I'm saying with this asset class I've created, this mythical asset class, which will be scenario one in the calculator, if stocks can beat that, if the worst case scenario for stocks is no worse than the worst case scenario for this extreme low risk asset class, then I think it's fair to say stocks are less risky than bonds. Because bonds, you can't say that you're always going to go up 2.5% real per year. Clearly, in a high inflation environment, bonds would have a negative return, not a positive 2.5% real. So I'm creating an asset class a good bit less risky than bonds. And then showing that stocks are less risky than that. Okay? The things I entered into the calculator, I created four scenarios. And what the calculator does, you probably haven't seen it. It's a new calculator. What the calculator does is you can enter up to four strategies and compare them. And what the calculator does is it when it creates its graphic, it'll show you there are four color bars for each strategy: a green, a blue, a yellow, and a red. And the calculator takes the strategy you created and runs 1,000 30-year return sequences. The sequences are all consistent with what we get in the historical record. And the green bar tells you the results, the range of results for the 250 best of those 1,000 tests. And the blue bar tells you the results for 250 through 500. And the yellow bar tells you 500 through 750. And the red bar tells you 750 through 1,000. So looking at the four color bars, you get a sense of the probabilities of various sorts of outcomes for that strategy. So I created four strategies, and then the calculator reports results at 5 years out, 10 years out, 15 years, 20 years, 25 years, and 30 years. Now, to get this, you can do this yourself. Go to the calculator, Investment Strategy Tester, at the website, passionsaving.com. read the instructions on how to work the calculator, and then enter these specifications. On your first scenario, that you're going to want to create four scenarios, you need to create it under the function that allows you to compare. It's the fifth of the five functions, the one that lets you combine different types of scenarios. In each of them, each of the four scenarios created, I entered $100,000 as my starting portfolio, just to keep everything simple. I had no withdrawals or additions. Just leave it at $100,000 and see how it grows over time. 2.5% is the TIPS return. For the first scenario, I created a 0% stock allocation. So all the money is going to go to the TIPS. All the money's going to my mythical asset class, the asset class that never loses, that always gains at least 2.5% real per year, and never more than that. But we're not looking at the upside. Remember, we're only looking at the downside. So it always gains 2.5% real per year. For the second scenario, it doesn't matter, in the first scenario, it doesn't matter what kind of PE10 level applies, so just choose any one. It shouldn't make any difference. For the second scenario, third, and fourth scenarios, I chose 70% stock allocations. So when I say stocks are less risky than bonds, I'm talking about a 70% stock allocation. That's a healthy stock allocation. That's a fairly high stock allocation. In scenario two, I entered a PE10 level of 8 in a normal market, not a bear market, a PE10 of 8 in a normal market. That's a very low PE10 level. So, you know, that's the sort of environment in which stocks are going to perform well. For scenario 3, I entered a PE10 level of 14, which is a normal, fair value PE10 level. That's the PE10 level that applies today. And again, a normal market, not a bear market. For the fourth scenario, I entered a PE10 level of 20. So a 20 PE10 level, which is a high PE10 level. So I'm essentially testing stocks at three different PE10 levels against an asset class that always gains 2.5% real per year, and which thus can fairly be described as a very low risk asset class. What do we find? Well, what we find is the scenario one on the calculator just is a line, because there is no range of results. You know exactly what the result's going to be in all cases. If you look at what we want to look at is the worst case scenario, the bottom of the red color bar, because that's risk. Your risk is your worst case scenario. So what we want to find is that the risk for stocks, the bottom of the red color bar, is either equal to or higher than the line for the scenario one asset class. That's what we're trying to find. And if that's true, it's fair to say that the risk of stocks is less than the risk for bonds. When you look at the color bars for scenario two, which is what happens with stocks when you buy them at an 8 PE10 level, a low price level, the line for scenario one at 5 years out is at exactly the place where the bottom of the red color bar is for stocks. That means the worst case scenario for stocks is that you will gain 2.5% real per year for the first 5 years. That ain't risky. That's mighty safe. And at 10 years, it gets better. At 10 years, the mythical asset class that gives 2.5% real every year, the worst case, there's only one case for that. The worst case is also the best case. But the worst case and the best case for that asset class is far lower than the worst case for stocks. So at 10 years, the risk of stocks is dramatically less than for the asset class we're using to look at the risk for bonds. In the real world, the risk of bonds is greater than this. At 15 years, that's even more so. At 20 years, even more so. 25, more so. 30, more so. The worst you ever get from a PE10 level of 8 is equal risk. At 5 years, the risk is equal. The worst case scenario is equal to an asset class that gains 2.5% real every year. And for all the other time periods, the risk is far less for stocks. Now, let's move to scenario three. This is where we're at a normal market, a normal P10 level, fair value P10 level. That's where we are today, P10 level of 14. How about that case? Well, in that case, the risk for stocks at 5 years is a little bit greater. I'd say the line for scenario one is about the 75th, 70. It's about the beginning of the red bar. So that means 75% of the results of the 1,000 tests, 750 of the 1,000 give better results than that, 250 give worse. So there's some risk there. Not huge, but significant. There is indeed some risk. But remember, this 2.5% real assumption is an extremely safe assumption. If you were really marking bonds here, I think that might be, those lines might be equal. The bond and the stock numbers might be equal at 5 years. Go out to 10 years, and the bottom of the red color bar is just about where the mythical asset class line is. So at 10 years, the risk of stocks is no longer greater. Might be a little bit. It's a little smidgen greater, I think. Not much. At 15 years, they really are even. The risk of stocks is not greater. At 20 years, the risk of stocks is less. At 25, less. At 25, at 30, way less. So if you buy stocks at fair value, there's a little more risk, at least in what I studied. I don't think it would be true if you were studying bonds, but I don't know for sure. I had to use this calculator, and the risk here is a little more. But of course, the return is much more. So you get a far, far greater return at a little more risk. And at 10 years, there's no longer more risk. The risk is the same. The worst case scenario is the same at 10 years, or at least close to it. Now, the fourth scenario I looked at is stocks purchased at high price levels, at a P10 level 20. And there, the risk for stocks is significantly greater. It's greater at 5 years. It's greater at 10 years. It's greater at 15 years. It's a little bit greater at 20 years, pretty close. At 30, it's about equal. Stocks might be a little bit. I mean, at 25, it's about equal. Stocks might be a smidgen better. And at 30, stocks are a good deal better, much better. There, I would say, when you purchase stocks at high prices, I would say, yes, stocks are indeed more dangerous than bonds, more risky than bonds. And of course, if you went to higher P10 levels, the P10 levels that applied before the stock crash were, you know, in the high 20s, the top of the price bubble, 44. So in those cases, yes, stocks are far riskier than bonds. But you see, you don't have to buy stocks at those prices. Now, the implications of this are huge. The standard investing advice is retirees should be going with much lower stock allocations than investors in the accumulation stage who have not yet retired. Is that true? I don't think it's true. I think it makes sense. You know, if you have a lot of excess assets, if you retire and, you know, you need $1 million to live on and you've got $2 million, well, it makes sense to invest in an extremely conservative way. Then you might want to put all your money in tips. You know, so certainly there are circumstances where retirees should not be investing in stocks. I don't disagree. But say that you're sort of on the margin. Say that you're retiring and you need $1 million to make your plan work and you've barely got $1 million. Now you're in a, you know, it's a tougher call. If that person takes all of his or her money out of stocks, I think that person's actually increasing the risk that there's going to be a shortfall. Because they barely have enough to get by on. And if they go with a low stock profile, yes, they might have the volatility in the first 5 years might be less. But the long-term return is going to be dramatically less. And that may kill them if inflation overcomes them. So I think an argument could be made that retiree is better off going with a healthy stock allocation if is the biggest word in the English language, if stocks are selling at reasonable prices, like they are today, as they are today. If stocks are selling at reasonable prices, I think it makes sense, even for retirees. I wouldn't go as high, probably, as someone in the accumulation stage. You know, I wouldn't advise a retiree to go with 80% stocks. But there are probably some retirees today going very low because they're scared. They might be going with 20% stocks or 30. I think I would be arguing that they should be going with 50 or 60% stocks on the thinking that stocks are going to provide far higher returns over 30 years, and many people who retire at age 60 are going to live to age 90. So you've got to be prepared. You might not, but you need to be prepared in case you do. And if you put all your money in bonds, you may be leaving a lot of money on the table. And without getting less risk in return, because bondholders are at risk of suffering from inflation. Stockholders are, as a general rule, better able to keep up with inflation because returns are better. So you actually might be taking on more risk by lowering your stock allocation. But the key is, you have to buy those stocks at times of reasonable or low valuations. If you retired from 1995 to 2008, everything I'm saying in this podcast, flip it. It's all the opposite. In those cases, it's not just that stocks are more risky than bonds. It's that stocks are incredibly more risky than bonds. You see, what's happened during the passive investing era is we got all of our understanding of risk wildly wrong. People were saying stocks are less risky the longer you hold them. Just the opposite was true. It was possible for stocks. You can buy stocks at high prices and get a good short-term return, but you can't get a good long-term return. The 10-year return was a negative number, the likely 10-year return. So we were getting all our risk assessments totally wrong. And the conventional wisdom became that bonds are the safer bet. Well, in an average sense, that's true. You see, all the passive investing studies look at the average because they don't pay any attention to valuations. The efficient market theory says overvaluation is a logical impossibility. Overvaluation comes from investors being emotional. And the efficient market theory is premised on the idea that all investors are 100% rational. Once emotion enters the picture, the efficient market theory is out the window. And everything you've heard about stock investing for the past 30 years is out the window. But if valuations really do affect long-term returns, and I sure believe that's the case, if that's true, then stocks purchased at reasonable prices are less risky than bonds, not more risky. You need to inform yourself. You need to be a valuation-informed investor. But if you're willing to look at the price tag before buying the stocks, you can get a higher return with a lower downside, you know, a lower worst-case scenario, a better worst-case scenario than you can get with bonds. And that translates into less risk. So the implications of this are huge. And my expectation is that as we continue our discussions, there are going to be more and more issues like this that for many years or even decades, we have taken for granted as conventional wisdom. And now that we've got the building blocks in place to understand how stock investing really works in the real world, we can question this conventional advice. Now, again, I don't have the confidence in this podcast that I have in the ones talking about the analytical invalidity of the old school studies, because I haven't studied it in nearly the same depth. This is one podcast I put forward. I would need to have thousands and thousands of people respond before I would have the confidence in this that I have in the safe withdrawal rate question. So please don't take this one to the bank. It's something to think about. Something to ponder, something to explore, something to ask your friends. I'd love to see feedback. I think it's right, but even I only give it, say, 60 or 70% confidence. But I think it's something worth exploring. I think it's worth something thinking about, because if this one checks out as the safe withdrawal rate one checked out, boy, we have turned all that we know about investing on its head. We've learned some very exciting stuff about how to choose asset classes, how to assess risk, how to choose asset allocations, how to think about retirement, how to put together retirement plans, how to contrast and compare competing value propositions, on and on and on. Please do give feedback, especially on this one, if you have feedback to offer. Contact me at the Contact Rob button on the left side of every page of the website. Good luck with your investing strategies.